Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "One's mind, once stretched by a new experience, can never go back to its old dimensions." In this podcast, we are proud to present our guests, the world leaders and pioneers in the fields of neurointerventional surgery, interventional radiology, and endovascular neurosurgery. We will bring you through their personal journey and the three cases that have marked their professional career. From the very first to the very last case, passing by the most enriching and challenging, welcome to this original format by Link Online, my first, my last, my everything. Hi everyone, my name is Nantia Suchichantrarat, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Monica Killer. Dr. Killer is a professor of clinical neuroscience at Paracelsus Medical University, Institute of Neurointervention, Department of Neurology, University Hospital of Salzburg. Dr. Killer, how are you today?
Thank you. It's fine. It's a nice day.
It's a very nice day in Paris today. You are right. So we're going to start from the very beginning. Can you talk to us a little bit about the path that you took to get here?
I'm a neurosurgeon from the educational point of view, and I decided to become a neurosurgeon when I did anatomy in my medical studies, because the brain was the most fascinating part of the body. And I did never think about that it could be difficult to get a job in neurosurgery, especially as a woman. So I was working there also in a scientific area already as a student, did my thesis there, and then I got a job. So that was a straightforward way. When I did intervene as a neurosurgery, I had the pleasure to be in a scientific group that started very, very early in the 90s doing interventions. So I was exposed very early to this kind of technology. So during my whole residency, I was in that group, and also my thesis already was dealing with AVMs. So the interest was there, and the vascular neurosurgery is the most interesting part on it. That is why I still am there, and I just made my way.
Now, your training was done in Austria, correct?
Yes.
And I heard that you also have a little bit of training in New York as well with
yes.
Dr. Berenstein, who's also a giant in the field.
Yes. That was the most of the pleasure for me, because I wanted to go to Alex Berenstein for a 2-year fellowship at that time, after my smaller fellowships that I did. And then I got the offer to go to Salzburg with my former boss. And he said, if you go to New York, you also can come to Salzburg. And I said, oh, really? But it was good for me, because we could build up an interventional unit. And that was then the decision to go to intervention only. Because I think, to be honest, although some people say it's possible, but you cannot be good in everything. Neurosurgery is such a wide field with a lot of spine and all these things. So I think vascular neurosurgery, as you can do it in the US, specialize on that, might be possible. But in Europe, it's not the way to do it. And that's why I decided to go only into interventional therapy. And there is so much innovation, and it's really great. I never had a problem with this decision, to be honest.
Well, this is Europe is the hub of all the new interventions. You guys get the first look for most of the devices.
At the moment, it will change.
I heard about that too, yeah. So maybe, pardon my ignorance, all of my training is in the United States, so I'm not familiar with how the training is done in Europe. Can you talk a little bit, as someone who knows training from both sides of the world, what the differences are and what your takeaway is?
So in comparison to the US, I think in the US it's much more structured, and you get really what you need to have to be fully educated when you stop your residency. I wouldn't say it's not in the same way, but it's far not so structured. And you have to fight for every case, you have to fight for everything what you want to learn, and it's a lot of self-initiative that you need to bring to get to that point, that you learn what you want to learn.
Let's shift gear a little bit, and we'll talk about some general questions. What was the best advice you've ever received in your career? From who?
To be honest, the best advice was from my former boss of neurology, who told me, it's impossible that everybody likes you. When you want to come along your way and want to make your career, you will have enemies, and there will be a lot of people that don't like you. And the more far you get, the worse it gets. And that is true. And knowing that, yeah, it's much easier then. Don't take it personal.
So converse to that, what advice would you give to someone just starting out?
I would say just go your way. It's nothing wrong or right, but be enthusiastic, have a lot of emphasis for patients, and whatever you do, do it for the patient, not for yourself or for any other one who forces you to do something and cannot be wrong.
Whose career in the people that you've worked with to date or people that you have come in contact with at these great conferences, whose career inspires you and why?
There's a lot of people that I would name here, but as I said before, Alex Berenstein is one of the really mentors of myself, and I really admire his way of being a doctor and being very, very successful, knowledgeable, and also the way I learned from him how to deal with patients. He can speak with a lawyer in the same way as a worker for something else, yeah? And he adapts immediately to the situation and has a really friendly, empathic way to do that and is very, very precise in his way of doing things. And this is a big example that I really have in my mind when you ask me that.
I know you run a GLP lab, good laboratory practice, out of your institution. Can you talk a bit about that and what that entails?
Mm-hmm. The GLP lab is an animal facility where we use all, I would say, the same angio suite. We have an OCT, we have an MRI, we have CT scan. We have everything what is available for the patient in a scientific environment. And GLP is nothing else than a quality management system that allows you to make studies under these GLP conditions, which when it is certified, what our lab is, you can submit these studies also to FDA and CE mark and all these things. It's very important before people go to the market with their devices. And how did I come to that? I would say it was the way that we started in neurosurgery when we learned access to some aneurysms, tumors or so. We always went to anatomy and learned how to do that, drills and how, yeah. And the same way when we started doing interventions, we said we need to train that before we go to the patient, because how can we do that? And that was the way how to start. We started with models, we started with animals, yeah. And out of this training situation, it came up that a new devices came out of the field. And I said, before we go to the patient, we start doing it in the lab. Because then you get familiar with the devices, and when I go to the patient, I'm already experienced. And it's not the patient who is my guinea pig, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this is really, I learned over the time. And then out of this, it turned out that it's very important to see prototypes in a very early time point when it's not ready to use, but what can you improve, what can you do better, and so. And also the engineers are very happy to get physicians' advices, and it's not only me who is doing that. Usually there is a bunch of physicians together who advise then what can be done better, and then they come with the next version and next version. So when I'm ready to go to the patient, I really know this device and I have not a bad feeling to go first in a patient. And I think this is very important for me, and maybe also important for the field, that you have such kind of facilities, and it's not only mine, to train physicians.
All right. Now we will go through the three questions about your cases that we ask everybody, okay? Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. Let's start with your first case. Could you tell me about the first case or one of the first cases that you did as an attending?
That's a good question. I don't even remember, to be honest. But usually it was, I'm sure it was a case that I didn't wait to do, because you wait so long that you're allowed to do a case for your own. And usually the older ones don't let you. They let you assist. It's the same in surgery. It's the same in intervention. And you can assist. You can do almost everything. But when it's going to coil the aneurysm at that time, the old one is coming doing the coiling. Goes away and you do the rest. So it's really the same as in surgery. But finally, when someone is not here or has something else to do, then you're there with the patient. And I think it was a coiling case in exactly that way, that he called me and said, just do it. I said, really? And it went well.
Yeah. It went well.
Yeah.
Good. Very good. All right. The second case is the case that's most memorable, most challenging, or career changing to you. Do you have something in mind?
It's maybe not only one. There is always challenging cases, and there is always cases that do not run in the way that you expect. And I think it's these cases that really change your behavior, your decision making. You always try to do your best and you always try to focus on whatever you're doing, but still things happen that are not very good for a patient. Although it's maybe not your fault per se, but you feel like that. And this is something, whenever goes something wrong and this happens, I didn't believe it also in the beginning that it happens to me, cannot be, but it happens to everybody. And then you really need to take advantage out of that in terms of learning, what can I do better the next time? And I think if it's once a year, once in twice years, whatever, but these cases are the ones that you learn. It shouldn't be just for nothing. Yeah.
And the last case is the case that you did right before you came to this conference.
Oh, yeah, this was a robot case, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because the patient has a large aneurysm, almost giant in the carotid. And we put a flow diverter there. And
supraclinoid, I see.
Yes.
Okay.
And it was very nicely looking after, I think, 6 months control, almost done, just a little bit neck remnant. Mm-hmm. And then we did almost... I think it was almost a year control, mm-hmm. and the remnant was growing. So I said, I don't understand that. How can that happen? Mm-hmm. Because usually if it's the way like that, it occludes after 1 year.
Yeah, that's surprising.
So we did, and she's a patient in her 70s. Yeah. So we said she's not old enough to leave it like that because if it's growing. But she's not so young that we want to do an old time an angiogram. So we did sinus CT, Expo CT. So we did all kind of examinations to find out what the reason is, but we didn't find. So finally we scheduled an intervention and said we do a control angiogram and maybe do it in a term of maybe we do an intervention or not. And we scheduled a flow diverter, a second one. And that was the idea, to put it with the robot, because this is such a precise tool to go into the first stent and then place the stent robot assisted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we did the angiogram, and I was so surprised. I never have seen that before. The stent was kinked at the level of the aneurysm neck.
Oh, that's
and
why, huh?
Opened the neck of the aneurysm, and that was the reason why it grows.
Oh.
So fortunately, we had done... Always in these patients, we do a balloon occlusion test before we put a flow diverter.
Mm.
And we were so lucky that we had done that, and she has really good collaterals, that the only decision was finally to occlude the carotid to treat the aneurysm.
Oh, wow.
What we then did. So it was a really surprising case. Nobody thought
to do
that.
I did not expect the turn of events.
Yeah.
So you always do balloon test occlusion to assess for collaterals.
Yeah. So in most of the cases, I would say there is some where it's so clear that the collaterals are good, but usually we do a balloon test, yeah.
Oh, wow. And you couldn't access to get another stent in there. It was impossible.
Impossible. We tried. Oh, wow. We were in the stent, but the kink was so heavy that we couldn't access it. And I thought it might... And before we had flow diverters, occlusion of the carotid would have been a good treatment to do.
Yeah, has definitely revolutionized the field.
Yeah.
And now for the last question. What do you hope to leave as the legacy in neurointervention?
At the moment, robotic is really something that I'm jumping on, because we face so many obstacles in the term of new people coming. Yeah, there is a lot of residences, but... not enough for the future, and especially stroke. And stroke remote technique will be one of the things to treat stroke in the future, because we are not able to bring all the physicians to the patients, and we are not able to bring the patients into the hospitals. So we will need specific centers with expertise, and there they will treat the stroke. So I think this is one of the visions that I have, and I hope in 10 years or whatever, maybe longer, that will be established, because it's the only way how we can deal with this problem. And there is a lot, long way to go, and a lot of improvement maybe to be done in the near future. But this is a vision I can imagine is the next step of intervention. Yeah.
Do you guys use robot a lot now in your
center? Use it to get familiar with the device, to get familiar with the procedures, to train all the people, because the robot is developing, and we cannot do stroke at the moment, because we maybe would lose a little bit time with all the preparations. We are not so familiar. It's not the daily base, yeah,
gotcha.
At the moment. But I think when the robot is ready to do it, we should be ready with our team and with all the behaviors that you need to change. It's minor things. But it's a routine that you have. And when you want to be quick, the routine has to fit. And I think that's why we start now and to be prepared in case we can do it then.
Wow. Awesome. So you do it in for diagnostic angiogram, like the routine cases or routine treatment cases?
Yeah, we do routine treatment cases because, as I said, the precision of putting a stent on a precise position when you want to do that. You know that as when you start doing these things, it's very difficult to hold the stent in position. Yeah. But with the robot, it's unbelievable easy to keep that position, yeah, because it's such a precise development of the stent, you won't believe it, yeah. So it's also, I think, an add of learning. It's easier to learn, and all these robotic techniques. I mean, the younger generation grew up with all these things, so it's much easier than
all the games we play. Thank you so much, Dr. Killer, for your time today.
Thank you.